Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain, where we lift the curtain on politics and theater. You know, two areas a lot of people think don't ever meet, but here they do. As the political analyst for WGN-TV and host of CLTV's Politics Tonight and Broadway in Chicago Backstage on the Comcast Network, we'll touch on everything from national, international, state, and local politics to the artistic side of our city. We're going to feature the hottest shows and theaters because when it comes to theater, New York, watch your back. Chicago gets it right. Plus, we'll look at other social and legal issues of interest to you each week, hoping to spark a little interest, ensure meaning towards the bigger picture, and maybe even spread some knowledge along the way. Get ready, everybody. We're going to raise the curtain. We're looking behind and underneath the scenes. Let's get to it. Oh, it's hard to believe that first debate between Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, behind us now. It felt like it was never going to get here, and it did. It's over. We need to talk about it and look ahead to what the future may hold for these two. So to get a perspective on these debates, a good friend, WGN-TV and radio Republican strategist is joining me, Chris Roebling. He is the founder and president of Clearspan Strategic LLC. This man understands what it means to be strategic in the world of politics, and now he's going to join us to talk about the debates. Chris, welcome to the podcast. It's your first time, but it won't be your last.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's great to be with you.
So as you watch the debates, and you and I were part of a pre-debate special on WGN-TV, so we had a chance to chat about it. But when all was said and done, you're the Republican. How did the Republican candidate Donald Trump fare in your view?
Well, I think that he gets an E for effort. I think that he did okay. I don't think that he did particularly well. He didn't hurt himself. That's extremely important. Nor did Hillary Clinton. So, you know, he started off strong. He kind of tapered, and he ended a little bit ragged. But I think he made a lot of very important points. And so I think it basically was a good debate for both of them. That's how I'm characterizing it. There are a lot of Republicans who are saying there were too many missed opportunities by Trump. I think there is something to that, but you can't look at the glasses half empty. You got to look optimistically and say he did okay, but everybody hopes that he's going to do better next time.
So we can be critical because that's our job here. We're not on the stump here for anybody. So let me pull this apart a little bit with you. And I think what some of your Republican colleagues have said may be true. I'm neutral. I don't have a horse in this race. But as I listen to each of them and I'm listening to the substance of it, what I heard from Hillary Clinton, no new plans, didn't hear anything new from her. But I did hear a candidate who clearly was well prepared, who had Trump lines ready to go, who hit him with his own words and comments and policies all the way through, some of which he even denied, but fact-checking shows she was right. And in him, we had a guy who said he wasn't going to prepare for this. I didn't believe him. But in the end, Chris, I think he actually was true to his word. He did not show a depth of knowledge or policy or even that he had done his homework in order to go after her. Not beyond the kind of level we heard in those primary debates. Fair enough comment?
You're absolutely right. You know, he was he did not prepare. That was obvious. And I think this might be the first time that we've all seen a presidential candidate whose lack of preparation was so clear to everybody watching, especially because, as you point out, Hillary Clinton was in there a little bit. You know, she's kind of like, you know, the third year law student who is the editor of the law review. And she's got the right answer to every question. And she's a little bit smarmy about it. But, I give her due. She's a very, very smart and capable and experienced public servant. And I think that our friend Donald Trump was going from the gut. He was shooting from the hip. He was trying to replicate the success that he had had in the primary debates, as you point out. Those were a very different operation with all of those candidates. So it was a moment of adaptation that took place apparently in front of 80 million Americans, at least for the first half hour, 45 minutes.
Let's take a look at some of the issues they talked about and some of the missed opportunities he had. They discussed tax plans, and Hillary Clinton laid out part of her head. She didn't do a lot of detail. No one gets in the weeds on those things at that point. But she talked about going to her website to check things out. She talked about the fact that a variety of economic strategists and analysts have looked at their plans, that his would cost the economy $5 trillion. She called it trumped up, trickle down economics. And the thing is, when it went to him, the question it raised for me was I was waiting for him to say, you're misreading my plan. Let me talk about how my plan works. Let me talk about these levels of tax levels and rates that we would move. It made me wonder. He didn't say a word about it, Chris, and it made me wonder how familiar is he with his own tax plan that the campaign has put out, because he didn't go there at all, and he could have.
I think it might even be worse than what you describe, Paul, and I say this with some regret. Yesterday, a 30-page, absolutely top-flight economic analysis of Trump's tax plan was issued by the Trump-Pence campaign. And this was written by a Harvard economist and a very successful private equity investor based out in Los Angeles, who has his own academic economic background. 30 pages. The last 6 pages of this document, Paul, are very in-depth economic analysis charts, okay? Mm-hmm. And they came up with some pretty strong conclusions about his tax plan. Now, I don't want to get in, like you say, we're not going to get into the internecine the details
weeds.
Of the tax plan right now. But you didn't hear him mention that, and I didn't hear him mention that, because he never mentioned it. And that analysis, which is very high-end and very sober, says that if you apply dynamic scoring and you apply a factor for the budget cuts that he's talking about, there's no impact on the deficit. None. Now, his campaign issued that at noon yesterday. He's in front of 80 million people last night. I'm sorry, on when, whatever it was, Tuesday night
Tuesday
or Wednesday
night.
And he's or Monday night, I'm sorry. We didn't hear about it. You didn't hear him mention it, did you?
He didn't know? Is it possible he didn't know?
I think that we're in a realm where a person like Hillary Clinton, with all of her background and experience, would never stand up in front of 80 million people and not know about a document that had been issued by her campaign that very day that made a very important point for her. She would have that intellectually or, you know, mentally on a 3x5 card, right? And yet Trump said, I couldn't get around to Benghazi. I wanted to get around to the Clinton Foundation. Well, he didn't get around to this either. And it would have helped him at that moment. In fact, as I was listening, I listened to the first half hour on the radio and the last hour on I saw on TV. Because I'm listening on the radio, driving from GN TV to GN Radio, I'm saying, come on, you're going to mention it. You're going to mention it, because I had already read it. Didn't come up.
You know, there were some people who say that that Trump does not have a large attention span in terms of learning details and dealing with all of that kind of thing. So let's just accept as a premise that that is true. If it is true, does that concern you? This is the person who wants to be commander in chief. If he really doesn't have the attention span or desire to learn those kinds of details, does it concern you that he then would be the man who'd be in charge of the economy, much less the military or anything else?
Well, less so the economy than some of those finer points of foreign policy, and especially ultimately issues of life and death related to U.S. military forces, and then the ultimate questions related to the rapidly changing strategic realm in which all of us live because of nuclear weapons in North Korea and anticipated nuclear weapons in a few years over in Iran, probably within the next 5 to 15 years in Iran.
Right.
And so you've got a situation in which you've got to ask about the chief executives, what we call the aggregation level. At what level of detail do the underlings aggregate the detail? And, you know, there's a wide range of literature on this about presidents, and Kennedy did it one way, and Eisenhower from the Army did it another way, and Thompson, you know, Johnson had another. But I'm not necessarily concerned, because the truth is, except for Jimmy Carter, who was not a particularly successful president, most of our presidents have been bigger picture people, and they're not bogged down by details. On the other hand, that's all based on a certain sort of, I think, bed of familiarity or a baseline awareness. And I don't think that Trump is missing that or ability, because how else do you put up a 90-story building in downtown Chicago by a world-class architect like Adrian Smith? So okay. He knows how to get things done, but I'm not sure that he as yet has that baseline awareness of some of the basics of government public policy.
You know, when they talked about his tax returns, and I grant that Lester Holt did not hit Clinton with the Clinton Foundation or Benghazi, that stuff. And my guess is Holt would say, you know what, that wasn't on my agenda. Let another moderator handle those in another debate. Don't know. But with regard to the tax returns, where it was a challenge for him, and he had to know that was coming. I thought Clinton had, you know, if you saw this as a little boxing match, she got a really strong jab in at the end, and it was this. When asked about the returns, Clinton, of course, said, we don't know what it means. Maybe he's not as rich. Maybe he doesn't give to charity. We don't know what it means. But we know that in the couple of tax years we've seen that he hasn't paid any federal taxes. And he very quickly sneaks in the line, that means I'm a smart guy or a smart businessman or something like that. Well, which was a nice little rejab until she said, well, what it means is you don't support the military. You don't support vets. You don't support education. All the things that our taxes go to pay. What she basically hit him with is, you're not supporting them. I was curious as your take on that, because the tax returns are a concern for some people, not others. That was a pretty good jab on her part.
I think it was a good jab on her part. I don't think that the point stands up to much scrutiny, because if the guy's out there, he spent $470 million, Paul, across the street from Tribune Tower or behind Wrigley Building. Okay, so how many jobs were created by that? How much economic activity was created by that? How many taxes were paid on all of that? You know, you can go to Mitt Romney or Bill Gates or Warren Buffett says, I don't pay a dime more in taxes than I have to. So, you know, depending on these super ultra high net worth individuals like a Bill Gates or maybe a Donald Trump. I mean, I think what he said last night is my income is in the neighborhood of $650 million a year, also known as $2 million a day. That's rare error. I mean, that's more than I make. I don't know about you, but okay. Well, it's up there. And folks at that level, especially with, you know, things like real estate investment trusts and all of the investment vehicles for which he's qualified or for which he's a qualified investor, you know, you get into these situations about taxes. But I think that here again, I don't think that he had the crisp reply. I don't think he had the crisp rejoinder, one of which is not just about Hillary and your 30,000 emails. I think he should press her on Hillary. Where are those speeches to Wall Street? And what is it that you're hiding about the speeches to Wall Street? Every voter, Democrat, Republican, independent, unaffiliated, whatever they are, every voter is entitled to believe that if a politician is hiding something, then there's something in there that they don't want you to know.
And makes sense.
You know, Hillary's State Department fought for 2.5 years in court to stop the Associated Press from getting her schedule. And the reason that they did that is because more than 50% of her meetings with private individuals had something to do with the Clinton Foundation. She had destroyed 30,000 emails. He has not released his taxes. There's something in there that he's hiding. There's something in there that she's hiding. And I think all of the voters have got to factor that in and appropriately discount their feelings for Hillary or against her, for Trump or against her.
Yeah, it's really difficult for either of them to hit the other one with transparency issues or honesty issues, because they're both wearing baggage in that. Again, because
exactly.
You're a Republican, I'm giving you these challenges to him in case, you know, anybody thinks I'm not being fair. This is because you're a Republican. That's why
No, you're not. You're being incredible. I think you should moderate the next debate based on how fair you've been.
Well, thank you. Please let me. But I wanted to ask you about the birth certificate issue and the birther issue, because on that one, where he just knew it was coming. He said he knew, and he said he made himself out to be a hero. And I thought, were you impressed? Was that the direction he should have taken it, or should he have simply taken it in the direction of saying it's been, you know, it's done, it's over? But he had to be a hero in that.
Well, he was crazy. I mean, that's called lousy preparation. He's got to say, she started it, I ended it. Barack was born in Honolulu on, you know, August 10th, 1961, or whatever it is. And it's ancient history, Lester. Let's get back to the issues that people care about. I mean, and I think allowing oneself to be drawn in to a discussion within which there is no point to be made of salience or significance to one's, you know, sort of target audience is an error. So that would be called an error on Trump's part. And I think that, you know, to get into, you know, let me give you six different reasons why I was right about the birth. That's not what he did. But, you know, going down rabbit holes is not a way to benefit from the platform that is a nationally televised presidential debate.
You know, I think it's also interesting in the criminal justice reform area, he always ties that to Barack Obama's hometown. Interestingly enough, Chicago is also Hillary's hometown. So he never seems to say that. I'm not sure if he knows. But let me, with just a moment left, I just want to look ahead and ask you about the future. So we've got another debate coming up sooner than later. If you were advising him, if he were to listen to you, my two-point question, Chris. One, what would you advise? But number two, do you think he'd listen?
Well, I don't think he's listening to many people. I think Ivanka, a small number in addition to that, that's about it. Here's what I would advise if he was inclined to listen. I would say, you know, Mr. Trump, you've obviously got to rest up because you were coming apart at the seams by the end of this thing. And number two, you've got to go through two phases of preparation. One is sort of an iterative question and answer phase. And then the second is an actual dry run. I mean, he has to go stand or sit. The next one is the one, I think, at Washington University, Paul, and there are going to be regular Americans in there who are said to be undecided.
It's a town hall.
And because and so it's a town hall. So, you know, this is the part where Bill Clinton stood up, got off the chair, moved closer to the audience and said, here's how much I care about the fact that, you know, your nephew lost his job at the steel mill or whatever it was that he said. And in many ways, he kind of sold himself to everybody in America that this was a guy who understood our deepest anxieties. And by the same token, this was where President Bush looked at his watch as in, gosh, I got to get on Air Force One and fly back to Washington. Are we getting late here? And so he has to physically execute one of these things in a dry run setting that's got to be videotaped. And then he's got to watch it. And then he probably has to go do it again.
Hopefully he will listen to you, or maybe he'll listen to this podcast and take it to heart. Chris Roebling, founder of ClearSpan Strategic LLC, and of course, a wonderful friend and Republican strategist for WGN-TV and radio and politics tonight, my show. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate your time.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Paul.
Talk to you soon. Well, let's take another look at one of the wonderful theaters in town. I love introducing you guys to theaters you're not as familiar with as you are with some of the, you know, classic big names like Steppenwolf, Goodman, those kind of theaters. But, you know, this is a number one theater city. I recently interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame, and he has said that this is the number one theater city in the country. I don't even think I'm misquoting him on that. So you really do need to check out all of what is available here. And I want to introduce you to a theater I came across about maybe a year and a half ago, called the Windy City Playhouse. And over on Irving Park, not downtown, not in the, you know, middle of the theater district. It's a place that you've got to go to, but you're going to have a bit of a different experience when you get there. You'll understand all of this. And wait till you hear some of the cool things coming up as you meet my guest, artistic director, Amy Rubenstein, joins me now. Amy, nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you really are. It's sort of an edgy theater. The first time I went there to watch a show, I felt like I was going into somebody's living room. Explain to the listeners why I felt that way.
Well, we're set up to really make the evening super comfortable and relaxing and luxurious. So we've got these really big swivel armchairs that turn, which allows for really flexible staging, but it also allows for a really comfortable evening and great night out. It's really social because you can turn in and talk to your friends at intermission and before the show and after the show. And we've got this really cool bar that's really chic and swanky with amazing drinks that our mixologists are always changing up depending on what the show is. And it's a pretty exciting place. Our idea was that we wanted to make sure that when you enter the theater, that this is a really exciting experience from the minute you walk in the door to the minute you leave. And so that includes everything that happens before the show, during the show, after the show, and we make it a one-stop shop.
Yeah, and I have to say, when you first walk in, it's kind of an unassuming place, and then there's the bar and some interesting snacks and things, and yeah, then you walk into the theater itself, and as you said, there's these big lounge chairs, and you're sitting down. You feel like you indeed are in a bar or a lounge, and you know, before the show starts and intermission, you're just chatting with your friends, actually talking to some people who are around you. How many does it seat? It really doesn't seat that many because everything is so comfortable that it's not like you fit every space with a chair.
Right. We seat between 120 and 150, depending on the layout of the show. It feels a lot more intimate than that, but it's somewhere around there. I think this current show is about 130.
So let's talk about – so that's great. So the point is I want to go out. I want to have an interesting night. Windy City Playhouse is a place I want to check out and over on Irving Park. But the kind of plays you do, and especially this upcoming season, so edgy. Let's start with what's happening sort of in current days. The show is called Apartment 3A. It's being directed by sort of a Chicago legend, Ron O.J. Parson, is directing it. But it's written by, I'm going to say the name Jeff Daniels, and people are going to go, wait a minute, that Jeff Daniels? And
that's what everybody says.
Is.
Jeff Daniels the actor?
Yeah,
Jeff Daniels the actor.
He's also a playwright.
Yes, he is.
Oh, by the way, let's address the media. For those who are going, wait a minute, yes, I know the name. Why do I know him? Go ahead.
Newsroom.
I'll give you one. Dumb and Dumber.
Dumb and Dumber.
Not the one he wants to associate himself with initially, but that's everybody knows him from that. But he's a very accomplished actor, serious actor, comedies. He's wonderful. And basically, he lives in Michigan, right? He's not far from. He's not an LA guy,
right? No, he has a theater there, and I think this was first done. This play, Apartment 3A, was first done in his theater.
Yeah, so he's Emmy Award-winning, Tony Award-winning. He's a musician. He's an actor. By the way, last time I interviewed him, he was in town for Turn of the Century. He starred in that show, directed by Tommy Toon. And so it was a real pleasure to get to know him a bit. So tell me a little bit about Apartment 3A running opening in October on the 6th.
And running through December 18th.
Yeah, so plenty of time to see this show. What's it all about?
It's a really beautiful and magical romantic comedy about a woman's relationship with two different men. And it's fun, and it's touching, and it's silly and very special. Not fluffy at all, but a really, really beautiful story with great witty humor.
And you got this woman, her name is Annie. She's gone through a breakup. I think we sort of witness a meltdown during the show, maybe, huh?
We witness a meltdown on public television.
There you go. So this is good stuff. And then it involves, of course, it's called Apartment 3A, so suggesting that a neighbor kind of comes in and changes her luck a little bit, changes her life.
She ends up having these relationships with these two different men. One is her neighbor, and one is a coworker of hers at this public television station. And neither of them attract her in the beginning, and they neither couples seem like obvious matches. And then she ends up falling for both of them.
And again, every seat is so close that you really feel you're part of the action. You've done Neil Simon's work there. I mean, just what is the philosophy as you pick a show? Because of the environment is so different, what goes into your thinking in terms of here's how we're going to create a season?
So our number one priority is to entertain the audience. We want to make
That's
sure
a pretty
the
good
audience.
Priority.
It is. It sounds like an
That's
obvious one.
That's a lot better
one,
than saying, let's not entertain the audience.
We don't want to depress our audience. We want our audience to see the world through rose-colored glasses. We want to be the theater that allows people to find the excitement and beauty in life. And we like to make people laugh at the same time, if that's possible, which is what we usually try to do. So we tend to lean towards comedies. But we want to also make sure that the play is very relevant, that it's very easy to relate to, and that people are going to walk away having a really great night out. At the same time, we never want to sacrifice the quality of the art. That's also our equal priority. And so we always have the best directors, the best designers, the best actors. I mean, it just doesn't get better than Ron O.J. Parson. He's one of my personal favorite directors in the city.
And, of course, as artistic director, you get to kind of have a little word about who's going to direct some of the shows, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So good pick on him. You know, I noticed I was pursing my lips to say, and you're also an actress yourself. You perform. And just before I was about to say that, you said, and we have the best actors. And I thought, well, if she's going to say best actors, I probably shouldn't say like you, but you're good.
I was not going to say that. I am so blessed and grateful to be able to work with some of the best talents in the city. So,
do you get to like cast yourself in any role you want?
Theoretically, that can happen. I try not to make it the Amy Theater.
Okay, if you end up doing Hamilton, can you like cast me as Hamilton?
Yes, let's do it.
All right.
Next week.
You can be Angelica. I mean, this is, yeah. It's
perfect.
Have you seen the show, by the way, Hamilton?
I am going November 12th.
Wow, okay. I saw it in New York. I'm not going to, you know, make a big deal about having seen it in New York or seeing Lin-Manuel Miranda's final show. Not going to make a big deal about that. but we'll do it one day. We'll get the rights. I'll ask Lin. We'll do it.
Let's do it, for sure.
But since that's going to be in a distance, let's talk about the this is actually only your third season, right?
This is our second season. This is going to be the final show of our second season. It's our seventh show.
Oh, no, the Apartment 3A. And I was already kind of looking ahead to the third season. But
our third season is coming up in January, right. And we are so excited about it.
And that's what I want to talk about. So for now, let's just remind people, Apartment 3A, written by, yes, that Jeff Daniels, is over at the Windy City Playhouse. So you don't want to miss it there. We'll say this before, but if you want to get tickets, go to windycityplayhouse.com. Easy enough address to remember. And so let's talk about the new season coming up. You've got some edgy shows including some premieres, Chicago premieres.
Yeah, two Chicago premieres. We're really excited about it. We open with Booty Candy, which is written by Robert O'Hara.
He's also going to be in it, right?
He is directing it.
Ah, okay.
It was in New York. It did phenomenally well in New York, and he directed it in New York. It's been in some other cities, too, but it's never been to Chicago. It is very edgy. It's a hysterical play, but it definitely pushes the line as far as you can push the line in a theater.
Now, I think it's kind of an autobiography, right? It's about sort of being growing up gay and black, and that's the look we get at this? Yeah.
Exactly. It's his semi-autobiographical story of exactly what you said. It's a unique story. It's a special story. It's an important story to tell, but it is really, really hysterical. Not a kid's show. Just putting it out there.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, you know, the truth is, it's funny you say that, or interesting, because, you know, there really is an adult ambiance about your theater.
Yes.
Have you done a show yet? I know most of the shows you've done. I can't remember you doing anything where I'd say, well, there's one to bring the kids to.
You know, we thought Explorers Club was good for kids. It certainly was not a kid's show by any means. My kids see everything. My kids are totally corrupt.
Uh-huh. That's a good thing.
But they see everything and love it all.
Yes, Mommy, you were really good on stage. Yes, Mommy.
But this one in particular is a very adult show.
Because of the language?
Because of the language. There's a flash of nudity. There's a lot of...
Where can we get tickets for this?
No, I know, right? There's a lot of sexuality in it. It is very, very adult.
Okay, don't bring the kids to this one.
If you're going to bring them, it's fine. Just know what you're getting yourself into.
Okay, all right.
But we are so lucky to have Robert O'Hara come and direct this for us. I mean, he's really a big deal, and we just feel so lucky to have him for that.
And so was it part of the deal of, like, I'm just curious now as we look inside, did he say, I'll give you these rights, but I want to direct it, or did you say, we just want to do this show if we can get you? What was that dynamic?
When I read the play, I fell in love with it immediately, but I knew that it was a risky choice for us because it does really push the limits, and we definitely it does talk about some pretty controversial issues, issues of sexuality, issues of race, and we wanted to make sure that we did it the right way.
Yeah,
and we felt like if the storyteller himself is telling the story, meaning Robert O'Hara, who wrote the story, that we couldn't fail. And assuming that we bring along all the other wonderful things that
usually. It's going to be true to life because he's directing, so he'll make sure that it is.
It's told the right way.
Yeah, let's talk about there's three shows in the season. The next one is King Liz, which takes us, it's sort of Jerry Maguire-like, right? We're in the world of sports agents.
Yes, it's about a woman sports agent. It's packed with action, lots of great basketball stories and lots of good drama. This is probably the least funny of the shows that we've done. It is a drama, although it has a lot of humor in it. But it's not a depressing drama. It's an exciting drama. Again, along the lines of Jerry Maguire. It's that kind of a show. Joni Schultz is directing it. She's fabulous and also a Chicago legend right now, although a newer legend.
Yes.
We're thrilled to have her with us on that show. And we're excited to open that. We're in the middle of casting it right now, so that's pretty exciting.
Booty Candy's in January, by the way. King Liz comes around in May, so we're really moving along into the season. But that's okay, because it's preview. Mm-hmm. People listen to these podcasts at all times, so they're not too late when they're clicking in, because if we actually go ahead to next September, that's when we begin to close that new season of yours, what will soon be a new season, with a show called Becky Shaw.
Becky Shaw has been in Chicago before, so it's our only one in the season that's not a Chicago premiere. It is a very witty, dark comedy. It's hysterical, very smartly written, and Scott Weinstein, who is a really hot young director right now, is directing it. And it's a ride. It's super fun.
Well, so I know it begins with the character named Susanna. She sets up her best friend with her husband's coworker. Thinks that she's, you know, it's one of those no good deed goes unpunished kind of plots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's they have this blind date that turns into a nightmare. the woman set up on the blind date, who goes on the blind date, becomes obsessed with this date and has a hard time letting it go. And it's dark and it's funny and it's exciting and it has lots of great twists and turns.
And the kind of perfect show if you're going to be sitting there with a drink in your hand, that they're nice in your nice lounge chair with a cocktail table next to you, by the way. So you're all very comfortable. I mean, it's almost like coming to this, like going to somebody's living room. You're kind of watching TV and hear these shows play out on stage. And it's really quite an experience, which is really cool. And I know this director, Scott Weinstein, he, in fact, he's worked at Theo Ubike, right? I think he directed Rent.
If I remember. Right.
Yeah, he does great stuff. So you really got a great lineup for this third season. Don't want people to miss the current show of Jeff Daniels' Apartment 3A. Yeah, that Jeff Daniels. And and by the way, the theater again, 3014 West Irving Park. I didn't say the actual address. I just said on Irving Park. But 3014, so it's 3000 West. So again, you're not in the world of a theater community. You're expanding the world of the theater community.
Yes, we felt like this was an area that had limited arts and entertainment in it, and we felt like that was a neighborhood that was excited about arts and entertainment, and so we wanted to bring it there. It's also really easy to get to from Lakeshore Drive, from the highway, from the suburbs, so it's a very central location, and you get to miss all the traffic going downtown, tons of street parking.
Yeah, that was good. So, I was going to say, when I went there for parking, I live in, I'm going, oh, no, parking, and it was fine. I found parking with no problem. There were some restaurants nearby. I had dinner ahead of time, and enjoyed the show. It was really quite a fun evening. The website again is windycityplayhouse.com, so you can check out the seasons, the upcoming shows, look at it for subscriptions. And again, we have great theater downtown, but you know, the city is big. The city has such treasures. This is one of those that you don't want to miss. And so I encourage you to check it out, starting with Jeff Daniels' new play, Apartment 3A, coming up soon, and then check out the new season. Amy, thank you for joining me. Amy Rubenstein, the artistic director and founder of Windy City Playhouse. You're doing great stuff over there. It's a unique experience, and I hope everybody checks it out.
Thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, same here. We'll talk again soon.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.